And this is stuff we talk about with our patients, because our military service members and veterans and first responders, they didn't get to be as successful and amazing as they are by taking it backseat and relaxing, right? They pushed through. Then symptoms became something they just compartmentalized and moved on.
This is TBI, Talking Brain Injury, from Brain Injury Association of Colorado. I'm your host, Phil, a four-time recipient of brain injuries I don't even remember, plus a whole bunch kind of sort of do remember. Today, I'm joined by Katie Johnston Brooks. She's a career neuropsychologist.
We're the person you're going to see when things in your brain don't feel like they're working right.
And she is sharing her firsthand experience as a TBI patient.
Not the right side of my head where I hit the ground, but the left side of my brain had sort of sloshed over and bumped into my skull, you know, on the other side, and there was bleeding on my temporal lobe and my frontal lobe.
For 8 years, Katie has worked with military veterans and first responders at the Marcus Institute at the Anschutz Health and Wellness Campus in Aurora, but she was forced to put her work on hold when her TBI symptoms turned ugly.
Be honest with myself about where the limits might be and pushing through and what the cost of pushing through is.
Today, Katie is back at the Marcus Institute. She admits her hours are shorter, but she is being more thoughtful about workload, recovery, and what it takes to do right by your brain. She shares all that and more with us today. A reminder that our guests are here to share what has worked for them and their own professional experience. Please contact your physician to learn what's best for you. Everyone, welcome back. It's TBI, Talking Brain Injury, the brain injury podcast from Brain Injury Association of Colorado. And today I'm joined by a very special guest over Zoom from the Marcus Institute. Introduce yourself.
My name's Dr. Katie Johnston Brooks, and I'm a clinical neuropsychologist at the Marcus Institute for Brain Health in Aurora at the Anschutz School of Medicine campus.
And I am learning so much about the Marcus Institute lately with, your director, Kathleen. She was on the show not too long ago. And now we're talking with you about, well, specifically, what a neuropsychologist does. And I've got to admit, Katie, that I've never seen a neuropsychologist. I've got no idea what you do.
Okay. Well, and sometimes when people say that, I don't know what you do, I say, that's good, because we're the person you're going to see when things in your brain don't feel like they're working right. And so you've had a brain injury or a stroke or other neurological illnesses. But really what we do is help identify the cause of what your problems might be and then recommend course of treatment. But when you're thinking about what a neuropsychologist does, the first step is for you and maybe your primary care or you and your loved ones get together and consider what are the questions that you want to have answered. Because I think picking the right provider often hinges on knowing what you want to know and what kind of help you want to get. And you may not know what that actually looks like, but coming to us with a sense of like, these are the problems, these are the main symptoms I want to work on, that helps us hone in our evaluation to be the most helpful. So this could be like, why do I have brain fog? Or why am I so fatigued? Or why am I more irritable or emotional or anxious or depressed? Why do I have trouble remembering new information? These are the kinds of questions that when we get that information, we can hone in on the right approach to the assessment and then ideas about the rehab or the healing. Neuropsychologists really conceptualize all of our humans functioning into categories like cognition, behavior, and then emotional functioning. So we know actually breakdowns for anybody, even with or without TBI, can happen in any of these categories. And that can result in symptoms. So while most medical providers take each of these into account, you know, really when working with a patient, it's neuropsychology who explicitly assesses each domain, cognition, behavior, and emotion, to better understand why, you know, our patients are struggling. So we typically see people with specific complaints in the domains of cognition or behavior, but we look at everything, you know, just to make sure we've got all the different factors. And when it comes to understanding, and we're clinical psychologists, so we have all that clinical psychology training, and then we marry it with a bunch of brain assessment and behavior knowledge that we can help understand really more the underpinnings of what's going on behind the symptoms.
All right. You know, it sounds like so much in the medical world these days that there is no one cure. There is no one solution. It's kind of this multi-pronged approach to, silver bullets don't exist. It would make life easier, nicer, right? I mean, it's the same thing with like my car when it breaks down. I wish there was just one thing wrong with it, but I know that there's like three different things wrong with that vehicle. But it's still important to go through all the different steps. And especially there at the Marcus Institute, the work that you guys do, you're not working in vacuums. You got a whole team.
Right. We do. And it's amazing. So when we assess a patient, there's a number of questions we think about. And as a neuropsychologist, I'm part of a team that looks at these each through their own lens. So we have to consider kind of what's the nature of the brain injury that happened or whatever happened, if it was a stroke or, again, a neurological illness. So that for brain injury, it's like, how long were you unconscious or how long were you had an alteration of consciousness? Are there any radiology findings? What was the context of the injury? What was the nature of the brain that was injured? Because everybody kind of comes into this with their own set of circumstances and things that maybe didn't enhance their brain functioning to start with, or they might have. So we've got education and enrichment, academics and work and social connections, all those things that promote brain health. But sometimes people come in the door with past histories of psychological and emotional functioning difficulties, substance use, their medical health. They might have histories of abuse and trauma. So we take all of that into consideration. And then really, we don't, at the Marcus Institute, we don't see people until usually years, honestly, after injury. So what's been going on since the time that they've had that injury? How's their sleep been? What kind of medicine are they taking? Do they have headache or chronic pain? What's their nutrition like? What's their medical health? And then we also use our assessments to look at cognitive strengths and weaknesses. So that is really like the role of the neuropsychologist, but we get to have a lot of information from the neurologist and the physical therapist and the speech pathologist, who looks at functional communication and cognitive skills. And so we can kind of rely on our colleagues to bring us a lot of other information that really folds into this, you know, this comprehensive picture that a neuropsychologist always wants the most information when they're trying to figure out what's going on. Because once you know what's underneath all this, then you know how to treat or help someone get on the path to healing. And I guarantee it's always more than one thing. It's never just like you said, it's never just that brain injury, because there's a lot of work. Humans are complicated, right? And our brains kind of do all of that stuff.
Yes, we are. We are complicated people, and especially treatment. Well, and so at the Marcus Institute, you guys specifically work with military veterans, retired or even active military, but you got a long history working with military. Before this, you were at the VA, right?
I was. Yep. I really enjoyed almost 20 years at the VA. And there, my primary customers were the Vietnam era veterans back in the 90s and early 2000s, and kind of them aging into times in their lives when they had cognitive difficulties. And I right out of grad school, I started working at the VA, and it's just really been my mission to serve those that really served us and make it possible, you know, for me to do the kind of work I love and live in a country that's as amazing as this one. So anyway, I wasn't in the military, but there's really a deep sense of dedication and honor it is to work with this population. We also work with first responders, active and retired.
Yeah, and now that's interesting. Now, talk about then, what you were seeing at the VA, you know, right out of school to today, you know, from the troubles people were having then to the approaches that are taken now, you know, what changes have you seen over the decades?
Oh, that is an interesting thing. I did not really focus on traumatic brain injury while I was at the VA. There was a whole team that was working on that. I did a lot of dementia evaluations and evaluations prior to like a deep brain stimulation surgery before and after that, or epilepsy surgeries and movement disorders, but a lot of Parkinson's. Our Vietnam era veterans with their exposure to Agent Orange developed Parkinson's, and I would get involved in those assessments and those treatments. But the TBI team was working mostly with the veterans who had moderate or severe brain injuries, which would be those that had loss of consciousness for longer periods of time. And the mild TBI group, while there were so many, and we watched the post 9/11 veterans, you know, coming through, and this mild TBI category was growing and growing and growing, and realizing that it wasn't as maybe not simple, but it was much more complicated than we, I think, initially understood when it came to mild TBI. We used to say, you know, 90% of people recover from a mild TBI, but the military exposure and with training, you know, and honestly combat, both more training than combat, these repetitive injuries that did not receive treatment, that did not receive any time to heal, were becoming a significant factor in how our veterans were returning and trying to get back to living, you know, a healthy life. By the time I was leaving the VA in 2018 to come to the Marcus Institute, or 2017, I think that was all starting to we're starting to realize that and think about ways to help these more complicated vets who were having many had TBIs that they didn't have ongoing problems for, but there was a significant chunk that did, and that became my mission at that point.
All right. Yeah. And I'd say that's something that I think has really entered the public consciousness through like the NFL. That's where we started hearing about repetitive injury and the symptoms that, you know, these pro football players were having from constant head injury. But our veterans were dealing with the exact same thing, like you said, even going back to Vietnam era. And I'm sure long, long before that, anybody who's been in combat or done any sort of training, they've been exposed to this sort of stuff. I mean, again, I remember talking with Kathleen, your director there at the Institute, about, ways to better train, more safely train, so that our active military, they're not being put in situations that is injuring them without cause, you know, that they can feel safe going to work, even though their work is dangerous, that we're not putting them in unsafe situations before combat.
Right. And I think it is what we're finding out more about really all the time. We're learning a lot about, that's another reason why it's a really amazing field to be in. It's growing. The research is continuing. We're learning more and more. We're using imaging techniques that can help us identify maybe network level problems when typical static imaging like an MRI or a CT scan doesn't show a lot of differences or impairment or damage. We're starting to get better at looking at networks and how the networks are connecting and how different parts of the brain are communicating with each other and starting to break that down and understand that better. Yeah. There's also low level blast, which is honestly like just shooting heavy artillery over and over and over, where no one event is causing an alteration of consciousness. But after a day of being, say, on the range, a mortar range, every day for a week, you know, our service members are coming back with nausea, headaches, brain fog. Like it's these types of injuries that don't appear to be any one thing appears to have a significant effect. It's a accumulation of exposure to these low-level blasts, too, that are now kind of, we're trying to really understand the effects of that as well.
And I'm sure as the clinical professional, it makes the job just a little bit trickier, too, because there's not that one instance you can point to. So many TBI survivors, you know, we've got the car crash or the accident or the stroke. But, these repetitive, sustained ones are a whole different messy situation.
They're messy. Yeah, absolutely. And folks who love their jobs and want to keep doing it and know that that comes with exposure, they kind of take it and they say, we'll deal with it when we have to, kind of thing, you know? So admiration and respect to those folks.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, now I wanted to switch gears real quick because, since you've been working there at the Institute, you've had your own experience with a TBI. Do you mind sharing?
Yeah, sure. I was training for the Courage Classic, and I ride on a team, a wonderful, amazing group of people. And they're actually riding in middle of July. So it's Wheels of Justice. And if you guys want to donate to that, it helps children's cancer, is what our team is focused on. Okay, so that's a little ad for them. But we were descending Lookout Mountain, and I don't remember much about it, but apparently I hit a rock. I was probably going 25 is the estimate. And I hit a rock and I went down, and my right side of my body hit first, and you know, all the road rash and stuff, but the right side of my helmet cracked, and I lost consciousness, and I kind of was awake for the ambulance ride. And then as it turns out, when we did imaging late, I went to the hospital and spent the night and all that stuff, but had some broken bones. But I really was cognitively not well, and a lot of post-traumatic amnesia. I went to see my doctor. I don't remember doing that. She told me to get an MRI because the CT was clean. But my doctor looked at me and was like, you're not yourself. Let's get an MRI. And it turns out that not the right side of my head where I hit the ground, but the left side of my brain had sort of sloshed over and bumped into my skull, you know, on the other side. And there was bleeding on my temporal lobe and my frontal lobe on the left side of my brain. So I wasn't at work for 3 or 4 months after that. I was trying to work part-time, but my team was incredibly supportive, and I'm back to work now about 28 hours a week, doing 2 neuropsychs a week. I love my job. My team and my family have been incredibly supportive. So I've been able to get back to doing the work I love, but I'm still limited by headaches and, you know, fatigue, and yeah, my stamina is not quite where it is. And when I get tired, my brain really doesn't work the way it used to. And it's very humbling, I'll say.
Amen. I understand that, because those are the issues and symptoms that I dealt with when trying to get back to work after, you know, my largest accident that I had. Now, you got to tell me then, being on the other side, you know, going through those moments where they're telling you, you got to slow down, you can't actually do this. You know, what kind of challenges are you running into there where, you know, you're having to take the advice that you'd be given to yourself if you were in your shoes?
Yeah. I don't like it. Yeah. I don't like hearing that, but I know it's true. There's certain, a certain level of honesty that I've had to be be honest with myself about where the limits might be and pushing through and what the cost of pushing through is. And this is stuff we talk about with our patients, because our military service members and veterans and first responders, they didn't get to be as successful and amazing as they are by taking it backseat and relaxing, right? They pushed through. Then symptoms became something they just compartmentalized and moved on. And so I have a deep respect for not that I didn't before, but now I really appreciate, because I could not function at all near where I should have. If I had to keep doing my job and pretending I didn't have symptoms, I can't imagine the level of emotional and cognitive impact that would have had to me as a person going forward. It would change me, you know. It changed me enough as it was, but if I had to keep going and not resting and not having the support I had, I can't imagine the deep ways that would also alter kind of how I function in the world and who I would be after that accident. So I really had all the advantages of medical, family, work, my home. And I still struggle. So anyway, I just think that kind of healing needs that kind of, people need to wrap their arms around you and hold you while you're doing that healing. And if you don't have that, that's incredibly hard.
Yeah, that's the truth. And I've talked to so many people here about the importance of having that support structure, you know, no matter where it's coming from, having some kind of support. So you're, first of all, not doing it alone. And second of all, you got some folks to remind you, slow it down. Or take it easy. Or people who, you know, even though they're not inside your head, knowing exactly what you're going through, sometimes that outside perspective really can help, especially from people you love and you trust, and people that you know have your best intentions at heart. Because in the end, whether it's family or clinical providers like yourself, the best intentions are at heart. We're not telling you to slow down because we want you to fail. No, we want you to succeed more in the future, right?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah. And I think, and I don't know if everybody feels this way, but I definitely felt this way, that like, it really brought me close to the reality that a lot of sort of my, how I view myself, my identity was wrapped up upon sort of wrapped up in like my success, like what kind of successes, what kind of goals I could achieve, what kind of things I could provide, and what kind of things I could do. And I had to get like kind of real with myself about the idea that I was good enough, just sort of who I was, and it was good that I survived, and learn how to manage. I'm getting like kind of choked up. Learn how to manage that I couldn't achieve and perform, right? The same way.
I agree. And it's one of those things where I think back to my very first mentee that I had at BIAC. And I've talked about him many times in the past because he dealt with the loss of a career. You know, his brain injury was so extensive that he could walk, he could function, he could do a lot of these things that we need for day-to-day life. But when it came to fine motor skills that he needed to be a mechanic, he lost those. And he also lost some of the other skills that he needed for manufacturing, you know, a second career that he had found over time. And it was a question that he often asked himself and often asked me, and we spent a lot of time talking about it. He said, why was I made to survive if this is what I'm dealing with now? And it's a tough question. And it's one that at first when he asked it, it was scary. But then over time, he would ask it, and his tone changed, and it was more of a search for why did I survive, instead of wondering why am I saddled with this new life that I don't want. It was more of a, okay, I'm here. Now what?
Yeah. That's a huge journey. Yeah. If I had completely lost my career through this, because I, gosh, you know, as a neuropsychologist, I really like my brain. Like it needs to be a, you know, a good, healthy brain. And I was completely blessed by the fact that it wasn't gone. You know what I mean? I just had limited access or limited bandwidth initially. And it's gotten better over time. I'm still, and not just sort of always being complacent with, okay, this is the new normal. Like, okay, how can I keep improving? Right. So I'm going to go see, I'm finally going to go see a neurologist to talk to. I know I'm the worst. It's been a year. I'm going to go see a neurologist, talk to that person about headaches and maybe vestibular or neuro PT, right? This is all the stuff I do and associate with people like this every day. I'm finally doing it. And then I'm going to go see ophthalmology and maybe neuro-ophthalmology, because there's still symptoms that I'm kind of like, I wonder how much that's pulling my bandwidth down and limiting me. So, you know, but for a while I was like, okay, I'm fine. I'm good enough. And then of course it's like friends who are like, are you, is this, you know, could it be better? You know, maybe I should go get some treatment, honestly. So,
and sometimes I think that is the hardest step to take, is saying, all right, now I need the treatment. Again, it's not a sign of weakness or failure. It's a sign of, all right, I want to be better. So I maybe need a little bit of extra help to get there. And like I admitted at the beginning, I've never seen a neuropsychologist. I've never seen, well, one of you, Katie.
Yes.
But
well, we're here for you.
Well, so as I'm thinking about it, you know, somebody else might be thinking of this too. What are some of those, how do you pick the best one for you? How do you find somebody who's going to, you know, well, help you meet your goals as well? Because we talked about, you know, some of those questions you should have in mind, but how do you then, how do you pick?
So it, and then we're going to go back to the idea of like, okay, well, what do you want it? What are you struggling with? What are your concerns? Okay. And if it's like cognition or memory, attention, processing speed, then you might want to pick a neuropsychologist, because they're going to help identify what could be the factors underlying the cognitive difficulties. And they're going to look at all those things that I mentioned before, sleep, headache, all of that, health. And if it's primarily like emotional, depression or anxiety or lack of motivation. A neuropsychologist can also weigh in on that because, of course, those are brain functions. And so knowing how your brain is working can help understand what may be underneath some of those symptoms. And that might be the first step in how you pick one. I mean, it's nice if you can get your insurance to cover it. So I would start there. I would also try to find somebody with experience in brain injury. And you can find that out, you know, when you go to their website or some people really specialize in things like that. In this area, there's a lot of good neuropsychologists. I would look for someone who had a board certification, which is it's called ABPP, and it's a dash CN, so American Board of Psychologists Clinical Neuropsychology. So there's a website that you can go to and kind of find board certified neuropsychologists. And then they, once the evaluation's done, then they may not be the person you work with to heal or improve your functioning. They may say, these are the types of treatments you should be looking for.
It is a process. Again, one of those things that you got to have a little bit of patience for, that maybe the first person you meet's not going to be the end of the road.
Right. Exactly. Like, I think a neuropsychologist is a place to go when you have questions about what the cause of the problems are. And they can clarify, okay, you are having cognitive problems. I would go see an occupational therapist or a speech pathologist to learn skills, right, to manage and work around. We almost always say you need to see a sleep specialist because sleep is foundational. If sleep is disrupted, people, all of our cognitive functioning depends on sleep, whether or not we've had a brain injury. So yeah, the neuropsychologist is a great place to go when you still have questions about what's going on and what the right treatments would be.
Okay. And I am so, so lucky. You know, one of the things I've never had an issue with is sleep. If anything, I sleep too much. I've been that way since I was a kid. I was the kid whose my dad would throw water on me when I didn't wake up because,
oh my goodness.
Oh yeah. Because I would sleep through alarms. I would sleep through people prodding me.
It's your superpower.
It is. And I am so grateful for it. Although, you know, yes. I've had bosses over the years who are not so grateful for
they're not pleased with that.
No, my tendency to sleep in tight. I had a boss back in college, and every single year he would give me a ultimatum that I had to sign, and it said, if I am late one more time, I agree to be fired from this position, or I agree to, I can't remember the verbiage or whatever. And signing that thing was always enough for me to make sure that I showed up right on time. But every year for 4 years working at the rec center in college, I was made to sign one of those things because.
Gotcha. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Cause he knew I was going to sleep in. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Wow. Cool.
But my thing these days, memory. Honestly, that is the thing that is my long TBI symptom that I still struggle with. And it's an old analogy I've used a lot of times. My brain feels like a filing cabinet that was organized by somebody who doesn't know the alphabet. The information,
the info's
there, but man, it might take me a long time to shift through it or even find the right file to put it in to begin with. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a great metaphor. I use that with I do use that a lot with my patients. And so there's a lot of fact. This is what I would talk to you about if you came in to see me. There's a lot of elements that go into memory. You've got to be able to hear it. You got to be able to see it, whatever. You got to get it in, but you got to pay attention. So we got to look at all of that. Mm. And then once you get it in, how do you store it? How do you organize it? Because it's great to have it, but if you can't get it back out, you know what? It's not a lot of good. It doesn't do you a lot of good. So if your filing system on the front end could use some help, you know, and that's where like occupational therapy, speech pathology, and even some neuropsychologists do cognitive therapy, giving you strategies for that organizational element on the front end. And once you get it in the right place, so often retrieval becomes a lot easier. You know what file to look in, you know where to go, and it's right there at your fingertips. But still, even then, sometimes retrieval can be sticky, and having cues, reminders, and ways of, there's tricks and tips to kind of help you retrieve that information, even if you know exactly where it is. Sometimes it gets a little bit stuck there, but it's there, right? You're not forgetting it. Mm-hmm. It's not like dementia where those memory traces are gone. It's just more the organization and the retrieval of the information.
Okay. And I like to hear that, because sometimes I do wonder if, did I just, you know, did entire sections of my brain get erased? Did they get wiped clean? And, you know, I feel like, no, they didn't. But, man, it's so hard to retrieve that I'm like, yeah, well, I think it did. I don't know. You know, it's tricky.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that's what neuropsych, we've got ways of figuring out where along that process of memory encoding and storing and retrieving, of figuring out where the breakdowns are happening. And then we know really kind of honestly where to target interventions to give you different techniques and approaches to help support that.
All right. Well, and again, another takeaway, it requires work. This is not the sort of thing that, you know, it just overnight, suddenly I've got my memory back, right? It takes work.
Yeah.
It takes process. Yeah. It takes, commitment to the strategies. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And practicing is, you know, it's just like anything you've ever done in your life. If you're an athlete or on your job, if you learning something to become second nature or muscle memory, you know, in a way, requires repetition and practice. And yeah, prioritizing that, you know, and life is busy and life is full. And sometimes it's hard to take the time for ourselves and throw ourselves into the work that's going to make our lives better.
Yeah. And I'm going to celebrate my memory right now. I just heard a quote and I can actually remember it.
Go, do it.
It reminds me of Warren Miller. I've been reading his biography, and in it he says that one of the best pieces of advice he ever got was, it will take an entire lifetime of work to become an overnight success. And I love that. And I've been,
love that.
Oh, I've been thinking about that so often lately, because, you know, it's just, yeah, there's overnight successes, but what you don't see is all the work that went into it before then, and the work that goes into maintaining it. Right. Yeah.
Right. Right. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. That's it.
All right. Great. Well, Katie, thanks again for making time to talk a little bit about what you're doing there at the Marcus Institute, and especially some helpful tricks and tips for folks who are thinking, I'm stuck, or I need a little bit of extra help. You know, where can I go? How can a neuropsych help me?
Yeah, sounds good. You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
It's been great having you here on TBI Talking Brain Injury, the Brain Injury Podcast, and best of luck in your own recovery journey. I hope for the best as you go on to see a neurologist, finally.
Thank you. Yeah, it's not over till it's over, right? So I'm still in their swing for sure.
That's the truth. Well, thanks for being here. It was great to have you.
Thanks. Have a good day.
You too.